I haven't been able to make contact with him. The few cues I got didn't sound like it was serious, but hospitalization is not a very pleasant word, so I'm still trying to make contact with Kevin or his wife to get some information. Excuse me. I'll get him rescheduled on the program as soon as I can. It'll be sometime after the holidays. But, Rodney, are we on? Not yet. Anyway, we want to discuss some of the major things going on. Let me just mention how I spent my morning. Well, I spend it the way I spend every morning. I spend it writing, and I seem to manage to get an awful lot done. I'm into an article on Syria. I'll get that done. I've written so many articles on Syria, and after the news about John Kerry yesterday, Press TV interviewed me on John Kerry briefly. And another service also interviewed me on John Kerry before the official announcement was made. And the tone of that other interview, which was an online interview, was, what difference will there be, if any, between Kerry at state? I've got a frog in my throat that won't go away. I'll get rid of it. It's a little bit stubborn. Between Kerry at state and Hillary Clinton. And I said in plain English, not in so many words, not a damn thing. The only difference will be in style and tone. Policies remain longstanding. They remain fixed. America's imperium is in good hands. Kerry is a longtime imperium warrior. Forget about what he says. Forget about some of the more left of center votes, you know, for stem cell research and things like that. These are important topics, but they don't rise to the level of war and peace. They don't rise to the level of Washington seeking imperial global dominance. And Kerry absolutely is in lockstep on those policies, and I can assure you that he never would be appointed to any high position unless he were completely in line with America's imperial agenda. Right now, he's a senior senator from Massachusetts. That will pass. I didn't spot an official date. Maybe Hillary hasn't given an official date. I would imagine it's going to be sometime after the holidays, probably before Obama's inauguration in late January. So in the next few weeks, this will happen. The baton will be passed. And Kerry's been in the Senate for 24 years. He's chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. That's like one notch down from Secretary of State. But, you know, all the undersecretaries and so on. Rodney, are you on?
I am here, Steve, and I'm hearing you on Senator Kerry. And if I could just make a comment to say that Hillary Clinton is probably withdrawing from things to sort of speak from on high for her presidential candidate.
Oh,
Susan
indeed.
Rice is a psychopathic Nazi. And now we've got Senator Kerry, who is 30 years on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, 4 years as chair. He supported the toughening of sanctions against Iran. He's too weak a personality to resist neocon forces. He's called for arming the throat slitters and the murderers in Syria. And even though he opposed the Vietnam War, we can expect no serious foreign policy change from him. The only change which is possible is if Chuck Hagel becomes Defense Secretary of State, but of course you can be sure that there will be the most ruthless campaign to ensure that he doesn't actually get nominated. So I think it's bad news, Kerry, and I wish it was Chuck Hagel was in at defense, but I shouldn't interfere. Sorry.
Oh, Rodney, I think I can say this with pretty certainty that I'm saying it accurately. There is simply nobody who gets appointed to a high U.S. position unless they're absolutely in lockstep with the system. So I don't know whether Hagel will get defense or whatever. But, you know, some look more benign, some look less benign. But there's no question, unless he is with the imperial agenda, he doesn't have a prayer. And if he supports it lockstep down the line, then maybe he'll get it. So, I mean, I have no faith within me. I mean, appointment to a high position in U.S. government automatically puts the mark of Keen on them for me.
Well, I think that's probably right, yes. Now, you had a little bit of delay in starting the program.
Yes.
And, of course, I worry that that the staff of the station, Heather just sort of spoke to me beforehand, but, of course, they're still suffering from the effects of the storm and consequences, and I just hope that they're not going to have too bleak a Christmas.
Oh,
and I hope
that
things have sorted up.
My first thought, Rodney, was did Christmas holidays start early?
Yeah. Well, maybe. My thought was Operation Hurricane. Anyway, now, we've done Kerry, right? You came in nicely there. Where should we go from here? Can I start off on guns?
Oh, indeed. I wrote about gun violence in America, and I could have included a lot more in my article, Ronnie, but I've written a great deal about it before. One of the early articles I ever wrote, and I want you to talk about it, but one of the early articles I wrote, I called America's Culture of Violence, and I talked about it at home and abroad. So I mentioned a few things that I wrote about in that article, but I didn't want to repeat what I'd already written. I spent an awful lot of time in that article about Washington's imperial wars abroad. And I did not include that in my guns article, my gun violence in America article. I concentrated on it at home. Can I mention one statistic from my article? I think I mentioned it on here. Of course, there were 28, I guess, people killed in Sandy Hook. One gunman, or maybe there was more than one. I think there's some dispute about that. But 28 killed. And I mentioned a statistic from Chicago in the first 6 months of 2012. 228 gun-related violent deaths. And I suggested, how many that made headlines? I don't think a single one. At most, if it got any play, it was very brief. It was on the back page of a newspaper. It might have been a 5-second blurb on TV, and that was the end of it. How about 228 versus 28?
Well, now, I'm a Limey and a Brit, which means that one really should not interfere in the local politics of another country. And I did actually see Pierre Morgan interviewing, I think it was the secretary of the National Rifle Association. And I really, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'm not sure that people should intervene. But I'm going to make not an intervention of saying what I think should be done. I would like to make two observations and warn you that the first one is bleak and the second one is bleaker. The bleak observation is that whether or not there is legislation based upon, shall we say, limiting assault weapons, the overall situation is simply unlikely to change all that much. As you know, the rise in the purchasing of guns has gone shooting up since the Sandy Hook killing. You've got about 300 million guns to a population of 300 million. About half the population own guns, and some people within that half own up to 8 guns. Why 8? I don't. You know, why isn't it 20 or why isn't it 2? I don't know on that. But the point is, it seems to me unlikely that the situation is going to change all that much, that you may get some limitation on one of the weapons. Now, that is a very bleak assessment, and it hits into what you were indicating just now. It hits into the violence of the films. It hits into these video cultures. It hits into the... I don't want to be pious about this, because when it comes to a history of violence, I mean, I live in the UK, and we're very, very good at that. But there is a history of violence in the UK, in the USA. It was based upon a repression of the native peoples and then of the slaves. Today, I think that Zionism actually is behind a lot of the violence in the films, because you see, the bottom line with Zionism, that it has to influence the USA, and to some extent the UK, particularly the USA, in essentially what is violent policy if there was ever to be an independent Zionist state. So I think that's an aspect that ought to be looked to. But one way or another, I don't, just as an observation, I don't see the situation changing all that much. Now, that's bleak. And now comes the bleaker bit, which is this. China is, within 4 years, will be bigger than the USA economy. The USA has exported Now, let me see how many business corporations has gone in the last 10 years. 56,000 business enterprises. That would work out at about 8 million jobs. And 8 million jobs, each job in practice, so they spend their money, supports another four or five. That's about 32 to 40 million jobs have gone from the USA. Such jobs as, that are coming in are low-paid jobs and insecure jobs, and they're the $10 or under per hour. You're on 47 million food stamps, and the price of food stamps, how much per day is, I mean, it just seems to be impossible that you could even get food for that sort of money. The USA is then being spied on every minute of the day. You've reinserted your National Defense Authorization, thing which enables you to be disappeared. You've got 1.4 billion dum-dum bullets. That's three dum-dum bullets now for every single citizen. You've even got an extraordinary thing where a state trooper can grope a woman's genitals beside the side of the road. Now, look, all putting that together, you have the march of a fascist militarized state, and this is the bleak part. In that, then you get the possession of guns being the only possible anti-fascist aspect. So I see that the situation not improving, and simply because the USA is riddled with guns, and because of the culture and the history, I see that people are feeling totally insecure, hence the rise in guns, so I take a bleak assessment. And then the bleaker assessment is not so much that the guns are in favor, it's that there is a fascism coming, and the only weapon against may well turn out to be your guns. I stop there. It's a horrific assessment of the situation, I'm sorry to say.
It really is very bleak, Rodney, and I remember, it's been such a long time now, but when Ronald Reagan was shot, I believe, in his first year in office in 1981, the Brady Bill followed, and that instituted background checks on people who buy guns. Well, I guess background checks are conducted, maybe how well they're conducted, I don't know, but the situation today is not only at gun stores or ever all the places are where guns are sold. I've never been in any establishment or facility where a gun was for sale. Or if I was in one, I didn't know there were any guns for sale there. I've never been in a hawk shop. I've never gone to a gun show. I imagine in downtown Chicago there were places to buy guns. I've never been in one. But I know for a fact the convicted felons in America can go to places like gun shows, maybe other places, and easily buy a assault weapons with no background checks. So we had the Brady, I mean, Ronald Reagan was shot. He could have died. You would think if anything was going to incite legislation, that would have. And the Brady Bill came. But I think when all was said and done, it didn't do a damn thing to curb gun violence. And I would say categorically, Sandy Hook won't do it either. There'll probably be something else, another cosmetic act passed, probably something like that. But a year from today, 5 years from today, 5 years from today, there'll be more gun violence then than there is now.
Likely. Okay, Stephen, well, we discussed it. It's very bleak and depressing, but I don't think that, well, there's not much more to say on that. Now, Stephen, can we now move on? I heard you commenting on what you used the word cowardice in respect of what is now an organized campaign in the UK, Germany, France, Spain, and the USA to suppress press TV, upon which you are a regular guest, and I too do various things. Now, last week I came back from a conference in Beirut, and it was the Bahrain Forum for Human Rights, and it was about Bahrain, except that you had this great variety of political activists and writers and from about 25 countries. I mean, there were linguistic difficulties. We won't go into that. But what was striking, absolutely striking, was the broad commitment amongst all sorts of different groups and things to democracy and to the freedom of the press. It was absolutely astonishing. And one thing which became clear there was that the UK could never, ever hold a conference now which said we will stand up for the freedom of the press, we will stand up for democracy. It would be immediately... It would be laughed out of court, and the same with the USA. And what we're talking about, say the suppression of press TV, is just that, the suppression of free speech and democracy. You've got the European Commission regularly now saying, "Oh, we didn't have anything to do with it." And at the same time, the radio stations or television stations are saying, oh, yes, we were. We're interpreting the European Commission. I mean, it's as bad as the situation with Obama and Israel. There's Obama stands up and says, well, now, the solution for this Palestine business is the 1967 borders. And then you have Netanyahu standing up and saying, we will never, ever go back to the 1967 borders, whereupon he then gives a V-sign and announces the latest extension so that Israel is now virtually permanently occupying almost the whole of Palestine and is embarked upon a slow, progressive genocide. Now, that is the scale of the problem. Complete contradiction between Obama's 1967 borders and everybody else's, and then the complete contempt of Netanyahu. And then in respect to press TV, you have on the one hand the European community and probably the UK government all being pious, saying it's nothing to do with us, etc., etc., and yet they are issuing the instructions to suppress press TV because they are simply scared. Stephen, the lovely thing about press TV is they never tell you what to say. That's not perfectly true. I was once in my early days told to shut up after 2 minutes and let somebody else speak.
Oh,
but with that exception, it's amazing. And you get, I mean, you go to the site and there are, you get interviews. And you can get viewpoints. I do a sort of regular weekly one on viewpoints. Amazing stuff, though. You get people like Wayne Madsen, Gordon Duff, Danny Schechter, lively people printing out the information of the alternative media. It's a wonderful stuff. All this, though, is being suppressed by the mainstream media. It is absolutely shocking. And it's now, you could not hold a conference in which you claim it's about democracy and the rights of democracy and freedom, etc. It would be the last word in hypocrisy, and everybody would, well, I don't know whether they'd collapse with laughing or whether they'd cry. And this is what we've actually come to today. That you have suppression now of freedom of speech and press TV. I mean, there's no pornography on the channel, etc. And they behave in the most extraordinarily reasonable way all the time. You know, it's almost the last sort of place that you would think could ever be shut down. But it's being shut down precisely because it is now telling the truth about the world. It tells the truth about the endless assassinations. It actually points out that Obama, yes, he was had a false, no tears in his eyes, talking about Sandy Hook, and he never, ever talks about what are now the thousands of children who are killed and assassinated by drones in places like Pakistan. I mean, you get the truth being told about what's going on in the Middle East. You get the truth which is going on in South America. You get it all the way round, and they hate press TV because you see there's something called Hispan, and Hispan is sort of press TV for the Spaniards, and there's press TV I think going now for the Arabs. And to your listeners, you just go on the internet, and there are at least six or seven satellite. They haven't succeeded in suppressing all the satellite channels, though they are trying to do this. This is egregious, pusillanimous cowardice. You said it first. You said it most accurately. You said it in one word. Well done, Steve Lenman. And it's shocking and it's disgraceful. My country's in it. Your country's in it. The Spaniards are in it. Because they're all controlled by these vicious Zionists. And notice how that the USA and Israel are now pariah states. Even the UK now isn't supporting them all the time. The number of people supporting the USA and Israel is down to a handful at best. There seems to be a madman in Canada who's putting Canada that way, to the eternal disgrace of Canada. But the rest of them are just states no one has ever heard of, and of course the vote is only obtained by bullying them, or usually $1 million into a bank account. I stop there.
Well, I absolutely agree, Rodney. Press TV had me on a couple of days ago talking about Hispasat pulling them and Eutelsat pulled them earlier. And both of these are owned, at least in part, by an Israeli. He has joint citizenship, a man by the name of DeRozan, connected to high levels in the Israeli government. You can be sure. I mentioned the Netanyahu government. Netanyahu is a world-class thug. That's the only way to describe him. I'm sure he's connected to Mossad. They're a death squad organization. Shin Bet, they're a torture organization. Probably the IDF, the Israeli army. I didn't mention them. I left them out of what I said on Press TV. Press TV had me on again yesterday talking about John Kerry, and I made the points that I made briefly today, Rodney, that nothing will change under John Kerry. And let me throw this in about John Kerry. Because it's in my eye. They asked me to talk about something I really didn't know very much about, so I looked it up. John Kerry is a bonesman. What's a bonesman? A bonesman belongs to the secret Yale Society Skull and Bones. The only people who get into it are ones tapped for high-level future leadership positions in government, in business, in law, in other prominent areas. And John Kerry was in it. He was at Yale a few years before George Bush showed up. Bush was in it. His father was in it. His grandfather was in it. Kerry is an extremely wealthy man. He's the richest man in the Senate. On his own, he's worth, I estimated maybe up to a few $100 million. I may be wrong on that. But his wife is the Heinz. You know, Heinz 57, the Heinz heiress. Estimates of her wealth range anywhere from maybe $1 billion to $3 billion. I put $1 billion in my article. I was conservative. I mean, you're darn right he's the richest guy in the Senate. And I remember writing in a past article, I don't know what he has now, that was a few years ago, that they own seven homes. They're not just homes. One for each day. The biggest decision every morning is, now what home shall we live in today? Anyway, he's a disgrace.
You know, within days of his first inauguration, it was certain then that there would be no change. And as far as I can see, there's no hope of change in his second period of office. He hasn't got the concept of it. He hasn't got the will. He can't outmaneuvering them. And even if he tries to outmaneuver them, Israel will outmaneuver him just by making sure a missile attacks an American ship. Then they've done it before. They'll have no qualms about doing it again. Obama, I'm afraid, has got no new ideas internationally, and he has no new ideas. I think you'll find that he's hoping that there'll be something like a Sputnik moment, by which suddenly the UK, USA economy will revive. It will not revive. They've exported all their jobs. They are serving only the financial elite, and the bulk of the population in America are being told to get lost. In no time at all, I'm afraid, you who should be the richest country in the world, you've got such wonderful agricultural lands, you've got such wonderful minerals, you've got such talented inventors and people, and they're hardworking. And all that is going down the drain. But Stephen, let's move on, and let me ask you a question. Why is it that that vicious twerp, William Hague, running the UK Foreign Office, is now sort of leading a campaign to say, oh, we want to negotiate in respect of Syria. And if you don't want to answer, I will tell you. It is because they realized that they are arming the most gruesome lot of throat slitters in the world, who are now starting to run the scene of the opposition in Syria. And they're just showing signs of saying, oh dear, we have cocked this up on a big scale, haven't we? The only trouble is, of course, is that the Israelis want all the states smashed up. But even the Israelis are so damn stupid, they can't realize that an Al-Qaeda type situation in Syria will put right on their doorstep a lot of people who will have no qualms at all in setting off an attack on Israel. I think the Zionists are beginning to just about twig that all their self-confidence cockiness that will follow Israel's policy will smash up all the states. It may come back to bite them. I think it will come back to bite Turkey. I think it's inevitably going to come back to bite Saudi Arabia. And it may yet come back to bite Israel. Over to you. What do you say?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree, Rodney. My God, the first half of the hour just flew by. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back and pick it up again. Welcome back, talking with Rodney Shakespeare, covering a lot of ground. There are so many topics, Rodney. I mean, literally, it's impossible to get into everything in the program. I'm talking about everything important. I was working on another article about Syria this morning. Maybe you might want to make a comment or two about the situation there. The pot still boils, which is one of the lines I put in my article. And just what's going to happen, I don't know. I would say one thing, and then you jump in. I think Russia is really going to the wall to try to figure everything it can to keep this thing from becoming full-scale war. By that, I mean NATO coming in, you know, Moscow. NATO has been involved from the start, but I mean coming in full force, putting these offensive Patriot missiles inside Turkey on Syria's border. That's a very, very disturbing step. Syria would never attack Turkey. Everybody knows it. And to put these weapons there, it's an invitation to really get something going and blame it on Syria. But I've been fearing for so long that really a full-scale war would erupt. And what Washington did to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Libya, it's planned for Syria, and they won't stop until the whole country is ravaged.
Well, as regards, first of all, the missiles, if the missiles are linked to some very high-tech radar stations, I think you'll find that the true purpose of that is against A, Russia, and B, against Iran. And the purpose there in respect of Iran is to allow an Israeli attack on Iran, and then, of course, to have sufficient radar and missiles from all directions to defend against what would be a massive counterattack. This is NATO controlled by the Zionists. This is NATO pushing against Russia. I mean, it was only, what, 3 years ago that NATO outrageously, the Israelis and the Americans, actually launched an attack from Georgia straight across onto South Ossetia. What on earth would be the situation if an attack was launched from, shall we say, from Cuba onto the USA? It's absolutely outrageous. They are pushing. You're looking, if NATO attacks inside Syria, a maelstrom would be too soft a word to describe what may well happen. I do think it's likely that Syria has chemical weapons, and I believe it's quite true. It will never, ever use those weapons on its own people. But there is the risk that those weapons will be captured by rebels. And if outsiders come in, then someone's going to be attacked. I mean, it will, of course, it could be sort of an Armageddon situation. It is absolutely horrific, and this is because you've got these people, these arrogant people, controlling Western foreign policy, who think that they... Syria had a referendum. It had an election based upon a referendum. And it looks to me that it was a reasonably stable country. And what you've now got instead, if you let in people who are not Democrats, you're actually arming ruthless killers. And in the maelstrom which is going to happen, it could then explode right the way throughout the Middle East. Anyway, can I move on to Egypt, Stephen?
Owen did. Let me just mention one more thing about Syria. You mentioned the referendum, and they also have a new constitution. They put both to popular votes, and they both passed overwhelmingly.
Yes.
Overwhelmingly. And, you know, it may not have been perfect elections,
but I think it shamed the elections,
the sham elections that happen in America that have no legitimacy whatsoever. One more thing about Russia. Russia has its own military people on the ground, and their mission is to protect these chemical weapons or whatever other types of weapons, if Syria has any biological ones, whatever it has to protect them, to keep them out of the hands of these terrorists. Russia is going all out to the wall to prevent full-scale war. Lavrov gave an interview to Russia today. He talked about some of this. Depkafile, connected to Mossad, has a piece up today on their website about admitting this, that Russia really is going to the wall and striking a blow against these insurgents because it wants to keep them from getting these terrible weapons, there won't be a false flag and there won't be the rest of it. And Russia is really playing the role. If anybody deserves a Nobel Peace Prize, I think it's Russia. You can give it to
the
country,
yes.
You can give it to an individual, but they are literally going to the wall to prevent another disaster in the region.
Yes. Okay, well, this is bleak. Now I want to move on, if I may, to Egypt. And the worst possible outcome has happened and is happening in terms of the referendum on the draft constitution. A constitution is not a law that you pass by a majority. It's not something that you can then sort of change. It's something which must cover the interests of the whole society as far as that is possible, and it should set the sort of the scene for, shall we say, 50 years or something like that. And therefore, on any argument, the voting for a constitution should be the considered voting of at least 70% of the population. But look what you have got. You've got, on the first round of voting, a 32% turnout. Then you have a relatively narrow 56% for, but in Cairo, it's 57% against. And, of course, the active political forces in the situation are going to be expected in Cairo rather than elsewhere. On top of that, if you have a president who thinks that he can go ahead taking just what is a narrow advantage in this sort of situation, then my guess is that he will immediately lose within a year or two a huge political support. But it is not right that a constitution should be passed through like that. What he should do is he should announce that he's going to review the whole situation, and he should take account of some of the fears and worries of the minor groups within the population, and then announce in his own right that he's going to put these amendments to a new constitution assembly. And in that way, he should actually end up with a constitution which is sort of reasonably agreeable to, shall we say, 70% of the population. But treating this like an ordinary law, which you can ram through by one vote, is asking for long-term political trouble and is showing a naivety in people who are not used to the meaning of democracy and don't realize that democracy goes much further than just the vote. It should go further to taking the account of interests of all people. And I'm afraid at the moment the signs are not very good
for a balanced future for Egypt. But it could be, of course, that after an autocratic government is thrown out, things go all over the place for a while. And let us cross our fingers and hope that. But it's not good that it's being treated as a narrow majority is sufficient for a constitution to be implemented.
Well, Rodney, I agree with you. I haven't written much about Egypt under Morsi, but I wrote a little bit. I combined a commentary on Egypt in another article, and I had nothing good to say about Morsi. I call what he wants to establish is an Islamo-fascist dictatorship. He rushed through this constitution. However he put it to a vote, it was put together, you could almost say slapdash, and thrown in front of the Egyptian people. I don't think Egypt in its entire history ever had democracy. It certainly can't construct it in a few weeks, and I don't think the Egyptian people had a clear idea or enough time to see what this document was, to decide is this something they really want or they don't want. And the military has run Egypt for many decades. I think the military has supreme power now, and Morsi is a front man. You can always tell if a leader is prospectively good or bad by the response from Washington when a person comes into power. And Obama called and congratulated Morsi, and Rodney, that was another mark of Cain that told me this is one badass guy.
Yes. Well, of course, you see, Egypt had already been duped into accepting a several billion pound loan from the IMF. And when any country today borrows from the outside, instead of borrowing from its own national bank, it has handed over control to the international finance capitalists. It's handed over control to the USA. And so I think Obama was quite right to congratulate Morsi. He was patting him on the back in a patronizing way and say, there you are, we've got you controlled, haven't we? And there's nothing that you can do about it. Because that, I think, is probably what's going on. There will be a fight in Egypt over relations with Israel. And that is certainly an unsettled matter. But alas, Morsi, having no deep new proposal for the independence of his own state, which must start with saying we use our own national bank for our own money supply and we never ever borrow from abroad. Unless you start with this is why China's been successful. It's never have to borrow from abroad. It wouldn't dream of doing that. It uses its own money supply. It may not do that well, but that is the way you keep your independence. But I'm afraid Morsi, he was the second choice candidate. Do you remember, Steve, that the army stitched things out? So what was the first choice Muslim Brotherhood candidate got kicked out. In other words, the army has got the candidate that they actually wanted. And in all of that, competence is one of the words. I wouldn't go quite so far as to say that it's all bad news. Given what was the situation, you must expect that there will be a reaction of people who are an Islamic people to vote for an Islamic constitution. But with that sort of comment, it's not completely gloomy. Morsi must immediately recognize that his nation could split, particularly because there's a 56 or 57% against the constitution in Cairo. Cairo is where, of course, all the political action takes place. He must pull in the other leaders into a consultative group. He should actually govern for a period with, a presidential committee of about eight, something like that, and be openly seen to take account of the other views in the country. If he doesn't do that, he's asking for a split nation.
Well, he certainly does have a split nation, and there have been protests, I think, going on pretty much regularly. And if this thing gets passed and he signs it into law, a new constitution, it becomes official, there could be a lot more bloodshed on the streets, Rodney. I mean, the Egyptian people at least are courageous enough to come out and fight for what they believe in. Americans moan and groan and sit back and watch football games.
Well, yes. Yes, indeed. Well, talking of moaning and groaning, we're seeing the pain increasing in Spain and increasing in Greece and increasing in Italy and in Ireland. There are question marks over the future economy of the UK and Germany. And all of this, of course, has got nothing to do with countries behaving badly. It's to do with a corrupt, failing system in which the failure now of each country affects the success of the countries near it or around the corner. And that, for example, is why Germany, a well-organized, hard-working country, is massively losing. Its exports, of course, are going out. I hope that in this new year that, yes, the Mayan calendar didn't come to an end, but let me hope that the old paradigm thinking is coming to an end and that everyone starts to say we must revolt intellectually and, if necessary, physically against the bankers. The bankers who do nothing to help the mass of people, who do not help the real economy, who do not spread the real economy, who are part of a financial elite sucking up all the wealth to themselves, and who have no solution to things like technological change, which is smashing out the jobs. The jobs in the future, the good jobs, are going to be relatively few. And there is no new thinking in the USA, no new thinking in the United Kingdom. Do you know what we've done in the UK? We've just appointed a Goldman Sachs man to the head of the Bank of England, which means that the Bank of England will never, ever be used as a interest-free money supply for the spreading of the real economy. All the Bank of England would be like the Federal Reserve of the USA, an institution which one way or another upholds the interests of a group of corrupt, too big to fail banks, which are now wrecking the economy. And please don't let anybody talk to me about triple dips. The triple dip metaphor is one which assumes it goes down and then comes back into balance. Goes down, comes back into balance, but always comes back. We have not got triple dips. We're looking at a long, steep slope, and there are bumps in it when little bits go up, but then you go over the bump and it's further down, and that is happening right the way throughout the Western economies. I'm very angry about it, Stephen, because you're not seeing a single attempt to find any new thinking. All you get in Europe is, oh, we must have more austerity. When they have more austerity, so at the same time, they smash the possibility of repaying the loans. I mean, they're just looking at it from the wrong way. You have got to stop the banks and necessarily bankrupt them and then open up a new money supply. You've got to get ensure that money is created and put out straight into jobs, so that each job created leads to the spending for another four or five jobs. This has been done in the past. It is understood. It is actually being understood by a paper from the International Monetary Fund, where they're now proposing controlling the banks. This was proposed by Simmons and Fisher and crew in the 1930s. And then, once you control the banks and their behavior, you don't stop people's savings having interest. You let the banks lend their own money, you let people have interest. But the major money supply must be interest-free for the real economy. So it's a two-step thing. People are waking up to the first bit. Control the banks. Put the boot in on the banks and say you're not scared of them. Because if you don't do that, the whole thing is going to... we're in a sort of, downward spiral of collapse. But at some point, it will suddenly slip into a bottomless hole. And when that happens, it won't be just the collapse of the dollar. It will be massive unemployment and a fascist repression. We have to stand up and be counted on the economic front, perhaps more than anything else.
Rodney, that's exactly where we're heading. Wrong-headed policies have been ongoing for many years, but especially since the economic crisis broke in fall 2007. And instead of taking responsible steps that are not rocket science to fix the economy, you need policies in place that will create economic growth. Growth creates jobs. Jobs put money in people's pockets. When they have money, they spend it. The economy grows. If it's done responsibly, it can happen inflation-free. It's happened that way many times in U.S. history and in other countries, and exactly the wrong policies are being instituted now. We have money printing madness. It's happening with the ECB across Europe, with the Bank of England, Mark Carney, the Goldman Sachs guy, taking a Canadian taking over the Bank of England. They couldn't find one Brit that could do the job. They had to import. They had to import a, what do you call a Canadian, a Canuck or whatever. Anyway,
a loony. Yes, it's the duck. It's the duck.
Well, I guess the loony is the currency, I guess.
We must put ourselves in the hands of people more expert than we are. Yeah.
Well, these people aren't stupid, Rodney. They know what to do. They just don't do it. They're doing all the wrong things because they want to let bankers suck every last buck and pound and euro, et cetera, out of the economies until they wreck the whole thing, and then they can walk away their money stashed in tax havens, and they'll let ordinary people be hot and dry. But literally, the longer this thing festers, the worse the explosion, the crash, when finally push comes to shove and a day of reckoning comes. I'm a great adherent to public banking. The U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says only the Congress has the right to coin money. Well, coin was the term they used then. To me, I translate that to print. Well, the bankers had over a century, or almost a century, December 2013, under the Federal Reserve, to get the system right. And under the Fed, they have run it worse than they ever did before there ever was a Fed. That's how bad they've been. There have been multiple recessions, a Great Depression, a Greater Depression that really is ongoing now on Main Street. The worst is yet to come. And these are the people that are literally wrecking the lives of billions of people around the world. It's time to take that power away from them. It's time to shut them down. It's time to prosecute the crooks, Wall Street, and across Europe, the major financial capitals. They're replete with crooks. It's time to hold them accountable, prosecute them, and put them in prison, and put money power back where it belongs, and grow the economies responsibly. But if people don't do something on their own, the governments will do nothing. They'll keep harming them. 20% unemployment will become 30% in America. I mean, the kind of employment that most people have in America, it's not worth even being able to call employment unless you've got three rotten jobs. You need three rotten jobs to come close to having one. It's terrible, and it's getting worse. And you got Obama, and you got all the rest of them, the rogues, signed on to this policy that's just crushing people.
Okay, now you mentioned public banking. I just want to make a comment. I've noticed that the public bankers are getting in a little bit of a muddle on something, and must get the language right. It is quite true that modern money is, if you like, printed or comes from the pressing of a computer. But we have to watch the language, because printing of money tends to be meant as money which is issued without repayment. Now, that can be a good idea, and there have been periods in American history when you had an expanding economy, and if you were printing money, say for government expenditure, then it was in an expanding economy, then the money goes out, can also expand. But one ought to be watch what the enemy says. As soon as you use the term printing money, they say, oh, that means issuing money for virtually any purpose except the real economy. And they then start to win the argument. They will say that will be inflationary. So I think the answer has to be that the public bankers must say precisely what they mean. And it should be this, that they should say that they will create money which will be interest-free and be repayable, and always focused on specific things. In certain circumstances, there could be non-repayable money. And I have actually written a book with Peter Challen in which we actually define those circumstances in which there can be non-repayable money. But I hesitate to go forward with it too strongly, even though I've written about it, because I recognize that you give a slightest little bit inch or whatever, millimeter, to the opponents, they immediately come in and they jump in and say, printing money, highly inflationary, Weimar Republic, 1923. But the public bank idea is an idea whose time has come in the USA. It also links in with a reassertion of the constitutional rights of your state, Kansas, Minnesota, etc. So that sort of state of your state rights, which may yet be the only possible bulwark against this fascist state which is coming into power so rapidly. So the public bank state rights are absolutely essential for the future of America, and thereby may well yet turn the future of the world. So I'm all for public bank. I hope they say that a little bit more definition in their use of terms is when they are meaning repayable and focused on the real economy and its spreading. And if they don't mean that, then let them say that. But watch what the other side do. They will always twist what is said. But public banking, certainly an idea whose time has come.
Yeah, I really believe it, Rodney. And I think money printed that goes into the productive economy for investment that creates jobs can be very non-inflationary. But if it goes for stock buybacks, for speculation, for buying up smaller competitors or maybe bigger ones, for all the wrong things that have nothing whatsoever to do with economic growth, therein lies the inflationary problem. Well, and of course, you can stipulate that in law. I mean, you can regulate this stuff. If you have the government creating the money, the government can dictate where that money will go. And if it does not go to play the stock market or the roulette wheel.
Time's moving, but very quickly, I say, not only non-inflationary, but there's a term I've invented for precisely this. When the money is created and goes into the real economy and the spreading, you get a balance of supply and demand, and the effect is not non-inflationary, it is counter-inflationary, and the word I have conjured up to express this is doe-flationary, D-O-E, doe as in a female hind, a female deer, something which is creative and quiet. But by counter-inflationary, you will actually get a growth in the real economy, and that's because the real economy grows, the money which is used to create it is taken back and cancelled. You actually have a decline in prices. I mean, it's an immensely positive idea, and I don't think at the moment that the public bankers in the USA quite realize what is potentially capable in their hands. I'll leave it there, Stephen. I can see that time is coming up.
Time goes by so fast, Ronnie. I look forward to having you back next month. Let me just wish you a happy holiday. Maybe one day we'll be on around the holiday season, and there really will be something to celebrate. Of course, if we keep working hard enough for what we know is right, maybe that day will come. It doesn't come, as I like to say, wishing doesn't make it so. It's only ordinary people deciding they'll protect their own interests, and they decide they're not going to sit back and do nothing. They're going to do something about it. That's the way great change always comes. It's my daily mission, Rodney. I know it's yours. Many, many thanks for coming on.
Season's wishes to viewers.
Join us again tomorrow, every weekend, of course, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.
The number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers. The Progressive Radio Network.